Chapter 13. The Moat House. The chat news: Warren's Moat House was enclosed by an old wall enwrought with ivy, and though not much of the exterior was visible at this hour, the character and purposes of the building were clearly enough shown by its outline upon the sky. From the walls an overhanging thatched roof sloped up to a point in the center, upon which rose a small wooden lantern, fitted with louvre boards on all the four sides, and from these openings a mist was dimly perceived to be escaping into the night air. There was no window in front, but a square hole in the door was glazed with a single pane, through which red comfortable rays now stretched out upon the ivied wall in front. Voices were to be heard inside. Oak's hand skimmed the surface of the door with fingers extended to an limas the summerer pattern, till he found a leathern strap, which he pulled. This lifted a wooden latch, and the door swung open. The room inside was lighted only by the ruddy glow from the kiln mouth, which shone over the floor with the streaming horizontality of the setting sun, and threw upwards the shadows of all facial irregularities in those assembled around. The stone flag floor was worn into a path from the doorway to the kiln, and into undulate ions everywhere. A curved settle of unplaned oak stretched along one side, and in a remote corner was a small bed and bedstead, the owner and frequent occupier of which was the maltster. This aged man was now sitting opposite the fire, his frosty white hair and beard overgrowing his gnarled figure like the gray moss and lichen upon a leafless apple tree. He wore breeches and the laced-up shoes called ankle jacks. He kept his eyes fixed upon the fire. Gabriel's nose was greeted by an atmosphere laden with the sweet smell of new malt. The conversation, which seemed to have been concerning the origin of the fire, immediately ceased, and everyone ocularly criticized him to the degree expressed by contracting the flesh of their foreheads and looking at him with narrowed eyelids, as if he had been a light too strong for their sight. Several exclaimed meditatively, after this operation had been completed, "Oh, 'tis the new shepherd, I believe. We thought we heard a hand pawing about the door for the bobbin, but weren't sure 'twere not a dead leaf blowed across," said another. "Come in, shepherd. Sure ye be welcome, though we don't know yer name." "Gabriel Oak, that's my name, neighbors." The ancient maltster sitting in the midst turned up this his turning being as the turning of a rusty crane. "That's never Gable Oak's grandson over at Norcom, never," he said, as a formula expressive of surprise, which nobody was supposed to take literally. "My father and my grandfather were old men of the name of Gabriel," said the shepherd, placidly. "Thought I knowed the man's face as I seed him on the rick. Thought I did. And where be ye trading out to now, shepherd?" "I'm thinking of biding here," said Mr. Oak. "Knowed yer grandfather for years and years," continued the maltster, the words coming forth of their own accord, as if the momentum previously imparted had been sufficient. "I and did you. Knowed yer grandmother. And her too. Likewise knowed yer father, when he was a child. Why, my boy Jacob there and your father were sworn brothers, that they were sure weren't ye, Jacob?" "Eh, sure," said his son, a young man about 65, with a semi-bald head, and one tooth in the left center of his upper jaw, which made much of itself by standing prominent, like a milestone in a bank. "Be but 'twas Joe had most to do with him. However, my son William must have knowed the very man afore us, didn't he, Billy, afore he left Norcom?" "No, 'twas Andrew," said Jacob's son Billy, a child of 40, or thereabouts, who manifested the peculiarity of possessing a cheerful soul in a gloomy body, and whose whiskers were assuming a chinchilla shade here and there. "I can mind Andrew," said Oak, "as being a man in the place, when I was quite a child. The other day I and my youngest daughter, Liddy, were over at my grandson's christening," continued Billy. We were talking about this very family, and 'twas only last purification day in this very world, when the use money is jied away to the second best poor folk, you know, shepherd, and I can mind the day, because they all had two trips up to the vestry, yes, this very man's family. Come, shepherd, and drink. 'Tis gape and swaller with us a drap of sommet, but not of much account. Said the maltster, removing from the fire his eyes, which were vermilion red, and bleared by gazing into it for so many years. He take up the God forgive me, Jacob. See if 'tis warm, Jacob. Jacob stooped to the God forgive me, which was a two-handled tall mug standing in the ashes, cracked and charred with heat. It was rather furred with extraneous matter about the outside, especially in the crevices of the handles, the innermost curves of which may not have seen daylight for several years by reason of this encrustation thereon formed of ashes accidentally wetted with cider and baked hard. But to the mind of any sensible drinker the cup was no worse for that, being incontestably clean on the inside, and about the rim. It may be observed, that such a class of mug is called a God forgive me in Weatherbury, and its vicinity for uncertain reasons, probably because its size makes any given toper feel ashamed of himself, when he sees its bottom in drinking it empty. Jacob, on receiving the order to see if the liquor was warm enough, placidly dipped his forefinger into it by way of thermometer, and having pronounced it nearly of the proper degree, raised the cup and very civilly attempted to dust some of the ashes from the bottom with the skirt of his smock frock, because Shepherd Oak was a stranger. A clean cup for the shepherd, said the maltster commandingly. No, not at all, said Gabriel, in a reproving tone of considerateness. I never fuss about dirt in its pure state, and when I know what sort it is. Taking the mug he drank an inch or more from the depth of its contents, and duly passed it to the next man. Wouldn't think of giving such trouble to neighbors in washing up when there's so much work to be done in the world already. Continued Oak in a moister tone, after recovering from the stoppage of breath which is occasioned by pulls at large mugs. A right sensible man, said Jacob. True, true, it can't be gainsaid, observed a brisk young man, Mark Clark by name, a genial and pleasant gentleman, whom to meet anywhere in your travels was to know was to drink with, and to drink with was, unfortunately, to pay for. And here's a mouthful of bread and bacon, that missus have sent, shepherd. The cider will go down better with a bit of victuals. Don't eat chaw quite close, shepherd, for I let the bacon fall in the road outside as I was bringing it along, and maybe 'tis rather gritty. There, 'tis clean dirt, and we all know what that is, as you say, and you bain't a particular man we see, shepherd. True, true, not at all, said the friendly oak. Don't let your teeth quite meet, and you won't feel the sandiness at all. Ah! 'Tis wonderful what can be done by contrivance. My own mind exactly, neighbor. Ah, he's his grandfer's own grandson. His grandfer were just such a nice unparticular man, said the maltster. Drink, Henry Frey, drink, magnanimously said Jan Coggan, a person who held St. Simonian notions of share and share alike where liquor was concerned, as the vessel showed signs of approaching him in its gradual revolution among them. Having at this moment reached the end of a wistful gaze into mid-air, Henry did not refuse. He was a man of more than middle age, with eyebrows high up in his forehead, who laid it down that the law of the world was bad, with a long-suffering look through his listeners at the world alluded to, as it presented itself to his imagination. He always signed his name Henry, strenuously insisting upon that spelling, and if any passing schoolmaster ventured to remark that the second E was superfluous and old-fashioned, he received the reply that Henry was the name he was christened, and the name he would stick to in the tone of one to whom orthographical differences were matters which had a great deal to do with personal character. Mr. Jan Coggan, who had passed the cup to Henry, was a crimson man with a spacious countenance, and private glimmer in his eye, whose name had appeared on the marriage register of Weatherbury and neighboring parishes as best man and chief witness in countless unions of the previous 20 years. He also very frequently filled the post of head godfather in baptisms of the subtly jovial kind. "Come, Mark Clark, come. There's plenty more in the barrel," said Jan. "Ay, that I will, 'tis my only doctor," replied Mr. Clark, who, 20 years younger than Jan Coggan, revolved in the same orbit. He secreted mirth on all occasions for special discharge at popular parties. "Why, Joseph Poorgrass, ye han't had a drop," said Mr. Coggan to a self-conscious man in the background, thrusting the cup towards him. "Such a modest man as he is," said Jacob Smulberry. "Why, ye have hardly had strength of eye enough to look in our young missus's face, so I hear, Joseph." All looked at Joseph Poorgrass with pitying reproach. "No, I've hardly looked at her at all," simpered Joseph, reducing his body smaller whilst talking, apparently from a meek sense of undue prominence. "And when I see her, 'twas nothing but blushes with me." "Poor feller," said Mr. Clark. "'Tis a curious nature for a man," said Jan Coggan. "Yes," continued Joseph Poorgrass, his shyness, which was so painful as a defect, filling him with a mild complacency now that it was regarded as an interesting study. "Apostrophe tweer blush, blush, blush with me every minute of the time when she was speaking to me. I believe ye, Joseph Poorgrass, for we all know ye to be a very bashful man. 'Tis a awkward gift for a man, poor soul," said the maltster. "And ye have suffered from it a long time, we know. Ever since I was a boy. Yes, mother was concerned to her heart about it, yes. But 'twas all naught. Did ye ever go into the world to try and stop it, Joseph Poorgrass?" "Oh, tried all sorts o' company. They took me to Greenhill Fair, and into a great gay jerry-go-nimble show, where there were women folk riding round standing upon horses, with hardly anything on but their smocks. But it didn't cure me a morsel. And then I was put errand man at the women's skittle alley at the back of the Tailor's Arms in Casterbridge. 'Twas a horrible sinful situation, and a very curious place for a good man. I had to stand and look baddie people in the face from morning till night, but 'twas no use. I was just as bad as ever after all. Blushes have been in the family for generations. There, 'tis a happy providence that I be no worse." "True," said Jacob Smulberry, deepening his thoughts to a profounder view of the subject. "Apostrophe 'tis a thought to look at, that he might have been worse, but even as you be, 'tis a very bad affliction for ye, Joseph. For ye see, shepherd, though 'tis very well for a woman, dang it all, 'tis awkward for a man like him, poor feller." Tis, said Gabriel, recovering from a Medita tie-in. "Why, yes, very awkward for the man. And he's very timid too," observed Jan Coggan. "Once he had been working late at the Albury Bottom, and had had a drap of drink, and lost his way as he was coming home along through the Albury Wood, didn't he, Master Poorgrass?" "No, no, no, not that story," expostulated the modest man, forcing a laugh to bury his concern. "And so lost himself quite," continued Mr. Coggan, with an impassive face, implying that a true narrative, like time and tide, must run its course, and would respect no man. "And as he was coming along in the middle of the night, much afeard, and not able to find his way out of the trees noho, a cried out, 'Man a lost, man a lost!' A owl in a tree happened to be crying woo woo woo. As owls do, you know, shepherd." Gabriel nodded, and Joseph, all in a tremble, said, "Joseph Poorgrass, of Weatherbury, sir." "No, no, now that's too much," said the timid man, becoming a man of brazen courage all of a sudden. "I didn't say, sir. I'll take my oath I didn't say, Joseph Poorgrass o' Weatherbury, sir. No, no, what's right is right, and I never said, sir, to the bird, knowing very well that no man of a gentleman's rank would be hollering there at that time o' night. Joseph, poor grass of Weatherbury, that's every word I said, and I shouldn't have said that, if he hadn't been for Keeper Days Metheglin. There, 'twas a merciful thing it ended where it did. The question of which was right being tacitly waived by the company, Jan went on meditatively. And he's the fearfulest man, bain't he, Joseph? Eh, another time he were lost by lambing down gate, weren't he, Joseph? I was, replied poor grass, as if there were some conditions too serious even for modesty to remember itself under, this being one. Yes, that were the middle of the night too. The gate would not open, try how he would, and knowing there was the devil's hand in it, he kneeled down. Eh, said Joseph, acquiring confidence from the warmth of the fire, the cider, and a perception of the narrative capabilities of the experience alluded to. My heart died within me, that time, but I kneeled down, and said the Lord's Prayer, and then the Belay right through, and then the Ten Commandments, in earnest prayer. But no, the gate wouldn't open, and then I went on with dearly beloved brethren, and, thinks I, this makes four, and 'tis all I know out of book, and if this don't do it nothing will, and I'm a lost man. Well, when I got to saying after me, I rose from my knees, and found the gate would open. Yes, neighbors, the gate opened the same as ever. A meditation on the obvious inference was indulged in by all, and during its continuance each directed his vision into the ash pit, which glowed like a desert in the tropics under a vertical sun, shaping their eyes long. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.